Welcome to Our Public Lands. This podcast is all about our beloved and treasured public lands, where I interview subject matter experts and activists from across the country who are working to protect and advocate for our public lands and their wildlife, wilderness, and cultural values. I'm your host, Adam Bronstein. The views expressed on this program by me or my guests do not necessarily reflect the views of organizations that I am affiliated with. If you ever want to reach out with suggestions about topics you want covered, special guests you want to hear from, questions or feedback, please email contact@ourpubliclandspodcast.com. Thanks for tuning in. In this episode of the podcast, I interview Dr. Suzanne Foudy and Cammie Ellingson, both past Forest Service hydrologists, to talk about beavers. Suzanne and Cammie share their insights and experiences about the significance of beavers in ecosystem restoration and water management. Our conversation covers the ecological benefits of beavers, such as water storage, flood mitigation, and habitat complexity, which are essential for both human and wildlife communities. We delve into the historical impacts on waterways caused by human activities and the potential for beaver restoration efforts to mitigate these effects. We also touch on the challenges and controversies surrounding beaver conservation, the practicality of beaver dam analogs, and the importance of protecting beavers on public lands in Oregon and beyond. I really enjoyed this conversation with Cammie and Suzanne. Their knowledge and experience with beavers and watershed restoration is really quite expansive. We spoke for almost an hour and a half, and I felt like we could have gone on much longer, so I hope to have them back on the program. But with that, I bring you Suzanne and Cammie, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Thanks for tuning in. All right, I've got Cammie Ellingson. Did I say your name right, Cammie?
Yes, you did.
All right. And Suzanne Foudy, thank you so much for joining me on the program. It's exciting to have both of you on to talk about beavers and your experience as hydrologists with the Forest Service, both now retired from the Forest Service. Did I represent your past roles accurately?
Yes, hydrologist and watershed program manager with the Forest Service, and not retired, moved on.
Okay. Suzanne?
And I am in hydrologist with the Forest Service and soil specialist, and I am retired.
All right. Again, I'm very excited to be speaking about beaver. And, you know, beaver's been in the news a lot lately. We're seeing it in the national news. Of course, we've all been heavily involved with beaver conservation efforts ourselves. Sometimes our paths have crossed. Sometimes we've been doing sort of our own things out there. But do you want to start, Suzanne, and just talk about beavers just generally? What are they? What do they do? And are they a native species? Whatever comes to mind for you when you start thinking about beavers.
Sure. And Adam, thanks so much for this opportunity to be able to visit with you about it and to visit along with my colleague and friend, Cammie Ellingson. You know, as you said, Adam, beaver are a lot in the news, and they're in the news because there is this growing awareness among the public the value in terms of water scarcity, the ability to store to help make up for diminishing snowpacks, increased unpredictability in the snowpacks, but also their ability as they create these wetlands to store water and to dampen flood peaks. So depending on where you are, if you're dealing with drought on a regular basis, beaver become really important. If in your headwaters, they're storing water in the surface and in the ground that can support the streams coming down. Later in the season, whether you're a farmer or rancher or a city that depends on national forests for your water. On the other hand, if you're in an area that is prone to flooding, having all that fantastic storage that beaver ponds and the wetlands create in the headwaters becomes this way of dampening those flood peaks and diminishing impacts on communities downstream. And then I would just add that in the process of doing that, it creates this, beavers create this wonderfully complex, interesting habitat that serves both human communities along the way and downstream, but a host of wildlife and a host of fisheries that benefit from these wonderful habitats that they create and allow these species, as well as the human communities, to deal with climate change better.
Cami, what comes to mind when you think about beavers, and how did you work with beavers when you were with the Forest Service?
Thank you, Adam. Suzanne's answer is quite thorough, but I would say that I've been fighting the good fight for beavers across the landscape, and especially Western Oregon, since that has been where I've been focused in my field work. What comes to mind for me is the controversy around beavers and my lack of understanding why it's so controversial. I often think about this, and I continue to struggle with an answer, except for relinquishing control of a dynamic system is really hard for people. And especially if your livelihood depends on it, or your road depends on it, or your favorite apple tree, or, you know, controlling nature to progress your own land management goals is what I keep running into. So for me, trying to find a way to find balance and compromise, thinking always about the natural processes at play, how do we best restore those? How do we best maintain those? And what are we facing with a changing climate future? And how are we going to be resilient in the face of that? And it's interesting, I give talks at schools, I've given science pubs, I was a part of a climate vulnerability assessment before I left the CITES law. And beavers can answer so many of the questions and issues that we face going forward if we just let them. So,
go ahead, Suzanne.
I just want to add something Cami said sort of sparked something. So Cami's on the west side. And, you know, I grew up on the west side, you know, in Seattle area, and now I live on the dry side. And so it's been really interesting that she and I have talked and collaborated. Some of the slight differences once upon a time that distinguished these two areas, one of which is drought, and now it's become, and wildfire, and now these two very large climate sort of driven events that people are really concerned about is across the state. One of the things that's really, like Cami, I am puzzled with is on a regular basis here in the eastern part of Oregon, ranchers and farmers reach out to the state for help during drought because there's not enough water to for their forage, to grow their crops and things like that. And this happens on a fairly regular basis. And here we have this marvelous species that in the headwaters could be dramatically storing water during the dry times to provide, just storing water during the wet times to provide during the dry times. And it seems as a smart move for ranchers and farmers to really support that, because it means that it takes some of the edge, some of the financial hardship out of the equation. And it also takes the pressure off the taxpayers. Because one of the challenges we hear a lot in terms of the state is challenges with budget. And that's only going to get bigger. So if you've got a species out there building ponds, building wetlands, storing water in the ground, helping to diminish the wet years and the dry years by this storage that's taking place, it's better really for everybody. And so when Cami talks about being puzzled, I have also found myself at times really puzzled why organizations like the Farm Bureau haven't come out in like, oh my gosh, this could really help our farmers and ranchers.
Do you mind if I add something? Thinking about that east side, west side component, it really struck me in 2020 when the Echo Mountain fire was happening and 300 homes were lost. In the asbestos forest, as everybody calls the Coast Range, which doesn't burn, but you know, 300 and 350 years intervals. So to see the humidity drop to 7% and to see the east winds blowing and moving fire down streams, both in the valley, but then on the coast as well, and then fires, you know, just across the state, it connected the issues for me in a very real way. And the water that we do have in the streams on the east, on the west side, is rain dependent. So if our climatic patterns shift and our precipitation starts to come in a 4-month intensified period in the winter months, but we go 8 months of the year in the Coast Range without rain, we are not going to have water. And we don't have the kind of snow that would be slow releasing and slowly melting water to provide water to our streams. And, you know, if 80 to 90% of the drinking water comes from public lands, that's a very scary future projection. And if we're seeing less fog and if we're seeing less rainfall, the vegetation drying and the wildfire risk is going to really shift, as well as what used to be in the Coast Range, if not across the entire state, were huge, stable, large wetlands. We don't have those anymore. And those large, stable wetlands would have provided the kind of climate resilience for what's coming. And since most of our stream channels are now ditched and incised and overdeepened, that also has lowered the water table, which also dries the vegetation. So that combination is certainly making me think about the west side differently. I'm always thinking about flood attenuation and muting those peak floods, but now I'm really thinking about wildfire and water availability.
So you're saying on the coast you experienced a fire that was sort of uncharacteristic, or it burned across streams that would have otherwise should have really acted as a vegetation buffer.
That's right.
So you just said that we used to have these stable wetland complexes on the coast, and we had them across the west as well. And were these in fact created and maintained by beavers?
Yes. Yes, they were. Yep, there's large historic records. There's a lot of historic records, not enough. And I wish I could go back in time and see, prior to European settlement, what this landscape would have looked like. I think about it all the time. The largest remaining beaver dam is in Alberta, Canada. I forget the scale of it, but maybe Suzanne knows. But certainly the records indicate that these depositional valleys, low gradient stream channels would have been river wetland corridors, essentially. If you look at any of Dr. Ellen Wool's work, you would see that, you know, these would have acted as a very interconnected, anabranching, stable, but sinuous stream network, and beavers would have been readily damming and holding water across, you know, large scale wetlands across that landscape.
Suzanne, I'll get to you in a second here, but you used some big words there, Cam, and I want to make sure we're kind of breaking it down a bit. So maybe you could describe how rivers, streams look today in the absence of beavers, and also in the presence of man-made manipulation of these systems, and maybe and what they would have looked like pre-Western colonization.
Sure. So there's quite a bit of record, both across North America, but also in Europe and in other places, where these large river systems would have had several shallower, in many shallower stream channel. It would have been a network of stream channels instead of just one overly deepened stream channel. And there's longstanding progression of, you know, things that occurred. And in the Pacific Northwest, splash damming was a big part of the influence of these streams and alteration of these streams, but certainly then using them as roads for navigation, but then also as roads to travel the logs to the mills were often constructed on the low flat tidal portions of the system, or just low in those flatter kind of valley bottoms. And then the splash damming would have occurred for over 70 years. From higher in the system, logs would have been collected behind large dams. And then those human-made dams would have been blown up or removed, or they would have a sluice gate where those logs would be released to go down to the mill. And that was how they were transported to the mill for, you know, over 70 years. That resulted in a scoured to bedrock, often, stream channel, one, deepened, over-deepened, and very much altered from the historic condition of a connected across a floodplain, shallower makeup of stream channels. The U.S. Swamp Act of the 70s also encouraged these low depositional valleys to be ditched to facilitate agricultural practices. People were actually paid to ditch their streams off to the side to get the water systems out of the way for agricultural practices. The same was true of tidal estuaries and really all wetlands. Dikes and tide gates were often paid for by large government agencies that incentivized that type of land treatment. So the result would have been, instead of this, you know, mini complex sequence of stream channels and then wetlands that would have been stable across those landscapes, removing beavers would have unraveled that. That, of course, occurred well before splash damming. By really the 1900s, beavers were mostly gone from North America. Splash damming occurred.
What are splash dams?
Those are those dams where the logs are collected behind them and then blown up or opened up to release the logs in a slurry, essentially, all the way down the stream channel, using it as a road to get those logs to the mill. But even prior to that, beavers would have been removed. So there would have been an unraveling of those low wetland complexes that would have been occurring kind of, in some cases, slowly and more systemically across North America.
Suzanne, what do you think about when you consider the landscape pre-colonization and just the impact that beavers had on this landscape scale across the entire continent? How impactful were beavers in shaping this continent?
Well, I think Cami has given sort of a really nice, broad perspective. Before I answer that, I think it's, again, interesting to see the difference between the east side and the west side. So while the east side also had splash dams take place, what we also had was mining. And so we had entire streams that were dug up and placer mined, dug up. And now are these channels, the sediment has flown downstream. And so that's another huge impact in addition to the roads and the urbanization and the agriculture that, and the ditches. I think when I think back, especially as I think back to what the system would have been like before Euro-Americans started taking them out en masse, I think about it now in the context of some of the challenges that we're facing. So we had some big fires here on the east side. And they came up fast and swept through. And there are ranchers out there who still do not know how many dead cows that they have because they were out there on public lands. And they were out there cutting fences as fast as they could. And one of the challenges in a lot of these places is that, yeah, there are streams and there are little tiny streams now and they're no longer wetlands. And so this ability of not only livestock, but wildlife to find these safe zones that allow them to make it through a fire situation has been wiped out. So you think about fire historically is that there would have been wetlands everywhere. And so when you had a wildfire, and the wildfires would have been different than they are now, you wouldn't have necessarily had the crown firing, the crown fires, but you had a lot of places where wildlife could go and hang out and be there and have habitat post-fire, which to me becomes really critical when we're talking about the now and how difficult it is for wildlife and for our native fisheries to survive these changes that Cami has talked about. So we've lost the diversity and the complexity in the systems. We no longer have these wetlands that post-fire where there might be some runoff and some erosion. That sediment, instead of being trapped in the vegetation that's on the wetland, makes it straight into the stream. You end up with ash and silt clogging the gills of fish. You end up with die-offs that are pretty horrific. And when we think about the fact that, you know, there's always been drought in the past and there has been periods of high precipitation and wildfire. But what beaver did is they created these landscapes because you had these vast bodies of water that held. And so in a period of drought, there might be some contraction of those wetlands, some lowering of those ponds, but you still had a lot of water availability. And that meant for fisheries, things were dampened. The impacts of the fluctuations were dampened. And again, when I think about our modern day situation, I was just, and this leads me to a question I've got for you, Adam, in a minute. So recently, there was an article in the paper, 80,000 waterfowl died in the Klamath Basin National Wildlife Refuge Complex. 80,000. And they did it because the water was stagnant, because of drought, because of these competing interests between different communities of humans, plus just limited water. And I think to myself, 80,000 waterfowl. And then in 2020, it was 60,000 waterfowl. And I sort of pay attention now more to my hunting section in my local newspaper. And it was interesting to see, you know, there was a talk about upland game birds and sort of the habitat that they need. And there's upland game birds that really benefit with riparian vegetation. And I think that, and there are places where they're like, well, if the ponds continue to shrink, you know, waterfowl numbers are going to go down. And so this ability to go from massive numbers of migratory birds, huge wetlands, the ability of species and landscapes to deal with that fluctuating climate, we've completely stripped it of that ability to do it. And everybody's vulnerable. Ranching and farming communities, which is a big part of where I live, cities and towns, and then our wild neighbors. And this gets me to a question I have for you, Adam, because I know you are an avid hunter and an avid angler, and I believe you're going to be heading off soon to the woods. It would seem from if you love to hunt and fish and you value those beings, that those species, not only for the recreational opportunity that they give you or the ability to put food in your freezer, but just for themselves. It seems as if some of the hunting associations are some of the most resistant to protecting beavers, despite everybody agreeing they can do wonderful things. And as a non-hunter, do you have any insight into that?
Well, I wish I had some insight into the motivations other than, you know, I always hear the slippery slope argument of if one privilege or right is taken away, then the next one just follows and then it snowballs from there. And I think that's a really counterproductive and, quite frankly, antisocial position. I think hunters and anglers need to take more pro-social positions, especially when it comes to an issue like beavers, where their presence on the landscape is so vital to the well-being of all of us, like you mentioned, Suzanne, human and natural communities. And of course, everything is linked together. It really saddens me that the hunting and angling, well, I want to say more so the hunting community is so resistant to this. And it's counterproductive, I think, to the sort of public attitudes that they might want, you know, that the hunting community might want to foster. And when people think about hunters, I don't want them to think about selfishness or just out for myself or this really tight group. And I know that's a human instinct, but I think that it's something that needs to be actively considered and turned around. Otherwise, you know, we're going to start losing more of these privileges if we can't act for the greater good. And it makes me sad that, you know, hunters can't come around to this. And I don't really have an explanation beyond that.
Adam, can I just do a follow-up question to that? Because it seems to me that there is, like in a lot of cases, there is association leadership that oftentimes does the speaking. And then there's everybody else who is out there hunting and fishing. And how much of it do you think is that, like most of us, we just want to go on about our daily lives? We want to do the things that we enjoy doing. We don't want to have to get politically engaged. It's easier to just not speak up, even if we're like, geez, things don't look so good out here, which is another question that I have. You know, I know some hunters who I have a lot of respect for. And what I'm hearing from them is that things are changing on the landscape that has them concerned. And I'm wondering if you can talk about some of the things that you see, both in terms of when you've been out of old beaver ponds and also what you've seen in landscapes in which, you know, the streams have become very simplified and you don't have these wetlands. Because I'm really feeling that the voices of those people who hunt and who value intact, healthy systems and really good conditions for the animals that they hunt and they fish should be of prime importance. So can you share what you're seeing? Because I certainly know that, Cammie and I certainly know what we see from a hydrology, water resources, ecosystem perspective. But that's really different than it is if you're a hunter and an angler, because it's personal in a different way.
Yeah, I think about this a lot when I'm out there, Suzanne, and considering the habitat quality and quantity as it exists today and how it could otherwise exist with more beavers on the landscape. Where I find beavers and active beaver activity, you know, it's subjective, but I know this can be objectified, like as part of the science, as you see more mammals, you see more birds. I find more ducks where I find beavers. And actually, as a hunter, I have not purchased a federal duck stamp to go duck hunting in, I want to say, 3 or 4 years because of the drought. I was just down in Nevada on public lands, and I was visiting some trout streams. And, you know, it's a low flow, right? We're just going to hit the new water year, which is, what, November 1st, I believe. And there's this little trickle coming into this creek that has what are called Lahontan cutthroat trout, which is a subspecies of cutthroat that lives in the Lahontan Basin, which is very dry. And this little creek that comes in and it backs up against these beaver dams and it provides habitat. And without those beaver dams, I don't think the trout could even survive there. And they're thriving there. They're getting like 17 or 18 inches. So, you know, the beaver is providing this critical habitat for the trout. It provides critical habitat for ducks. And I find more ruffed grouse in areas that hold more water and expand these riparian wetlands. So beavers are so important. So when hunting associations or groups are opposed to protecting beavers, you know, to me, that just takes away from, selfishly, from hunters and anglers in such a profound way. It's like it'll be either presence or absence kind of profound way. We're not just talking about the quality. We're talking about whether a species could actually be present in an area at all. Cammy, you talked a little bit about the connectivity of these wetlands and how important that was in the past. And also, it gets me thinking as we're talking about, you know, hunting species, you know, hunting opportunities in these areas, the sort of networks that beaver habitat creates. Could you talk a bit about why connectivity of wetlands is so important, but also the coevolution of beavers and all these species that are currently present on the landscape?
Sure. I'm glad you asked that, because the interconnectedness of all of this and the cross-cutting feature to me is the water systems. It's the streams, it's the wetlands all the way to the, you know, from the ridgetops down to the estuaries. And having been on the west side, you know, I'm always thinking about these processes, both, you know, from the ridgetops down through the transport reaches, how the sediment then moves down into the low gradient portions of that stream channel is collected, how that changes the shape of the channels in the low valley bottoms, if we let it, you know, how that attenuates the floods and takes on the floods if the water's connected to the floodplains, and then how that sediment eventually moves out into those estuaries and keeps those elevations in check as well. And that's if the whole thing is allowed to function. And we've, you know, of course, been tinkering and altering in some dramatic ways, some less dramatic ways, but that connectivity is highly altered. And the significance of that starts to come into play, you know, for young rearing salmon, for instance, where winter rearing habitat used to be abundant and isn't. And it's the limiting factor for Oregon Coast coho recovery. Or relative to how these systems are going to adjust to sea level rise or increased intensity of floods or longer periods without rainfall. And that connectivity from a population, from a wildlife population standpoint, is also essential. You know, beavers are system altering. They need to be in order for their own safety and survival to have that deep water to support their colonies, their families. And where we've altered the hydrology so significantly as they try to build dams, their dams are ephemeral. They wash out. They wouldn't have historically, but with that stream channel so heavily ditched and incised and operating at such a fast velocity, they don't really stand a chance in a lot of places to try to come back. So what happens is, you know, the bank denning occurs. A beaver colony will move low into the systems off of public lands and be working where they can. They're opportunistic and they're shifting based on what's available. In most of those low-lying areas on private lands, the populations are at greater risk. They don't have the opportunities then to build that population base up and be a source for the rest of that watershed. And they've also been moved out of many of the high watersheds off private industrial forest land. And then they're pinched in the middle by what they do on agricultural lands. So across that entire interconnected system, there's a difficulty in trying to bring back a robust landscape scale population of beavers. But if we could, and even if we could only, you know, if we could bring out back a small percentage of what there used to be historically, you know, the benefits would be immense.
Suzanne, I want to talk more about the benefits of beavers on the landscape. And I notice how you focused in on water, and that's sort of the central theme. So I just want to go through my understanding of the benefits that beaver provide as far as water. And maybe you could touch on some other benefits. Well, at least tell me what I've missed, and maybe you could highlight some of these. But beaver dams filter water. They, like we talked about earlier, they attenuate floods. So they hold back water. They elevate the water table. So this could provide more water for agriculture purposes. And it just, you know, regulates that flow over the season. Right? So it doesn't flash out. You actually have some water retention, and that's part of that water storage. What did I miss, and what other benefits are there that beavers provide?
Yeah, you know, that's a good summary. And for a lot of us, those are probably the most tangible things in addition to something we've been talking about, which has been the habitat benefits. And Cammie's talk about salmon, or, you know, your talk about Lahontan cutthroat or red band trout or whatever it is, one of the things in addition to the ponds and to, you know, complex side channels is going to be water quality and stream temperatures. And right now in Oregon, a lot of our streams are too hot for fish. They're above the state standard. And where I am here in Eastern Oregon, there is a basin called the North Fork, it's a watershed called the North Fork Burnt River. And in the 90s, in a portion of it, beaver were reintroduced. And at some point, they made their home on this little tiny piece of public land, and then it goes private and then goes back to public. But we've got some long-term temperature data. And in 2017, I put a temperature logger that would monitor temperature right as it comes off public land, private lands. And it travels then 500 linear feet. Okay, it's a little more sinuous, 500 linear feet. And in that less than 500 linear feet, the temperatures were dropping 5 to 6 degrees. Now, That's pretty significant when you're talking about temperatures that are getting into the 70s. And in the downstream spot at the lower end of this section that's got a bunch of beaver dams in it, you know, you just watch the fact that year after year, the frequency at which it's above the state standard becomes less and less. So that's in less than 500 feet. Now imagine if that's translating everywhere. So every stream that can hold beavers has got beaver dams in there, and you've got expanding willows, cottonwoods, riparian areas. And you've got cooler water coming in from all these multiple points. It decreases temperatures all the way downstream. And that has a huge impact just in terms of drinking water as much as it does for what fish require. And I think that the other thing is that as that water table rises and you get this expansion of riparian habitat and riparian vegetation, you know, there was a really neat study where I heard a talk of it, is that all that vegetation shades the ground. And that keeps that near surface groundwater cooler. And so that means what's coming into the stream from the elevated water table is cooler. So that's one of the benefits. And the other one is carbon sequestration and capture and storage. So as you go from, you know, dry landscapes to these wetlands, you know, the amount of carbon that you can store in the soil goes up dramatically. And given the fact that we've lost all these wetlands historically, that means a lot of that carbon is now in the atmosphere. So if we can recreate those wetlands at a large scale, which is what beaver can help us do, is we can begin to pull some of that back in. And I want to just give a couple numbers for folks who are listening in terms of just how significant the water storage is. So for instance, in a 1950 publication in Wyoming, there was a beaver pond and it was about 26 acres. And they estimated that the amount of water that was being held in this particular beaver pond was over 75 million gallons of water. And that if no more water entered that pond, that creek would still run for 117 days. Now, that's a really big deal when you're thinking drought. And you start to do, as Cami sort of helped get that big vision, that happening everywhere. So you've got, you know, maybe not a 25, 26 acre pond, but you've got 10 acre ponds here and a bunch of acre ponds here. And these things add up. And then there was just another really interesting number that in the course of 4 years, once beaver trapping was closed in an area, the amount of surface water area increased over 106 acres. Okay, as beavers built dams and expanded them. Whereas in the area, the parrot area that was trapped, there was absolutely no change. So you see these real tangible influences that come with it. And I guess the last thing that I would say is in terms of the contributions that sort of beavers bring besides carbon sequestration and storage and, you know, real water quality is, and I guess I think this is something that's really important to all of us, and maybe we can all chat about it just a little bit, which is just our responsibility and our obligation not only to our human communities and our neighbors, but to the future and to our wild neighbors. And so for any of us who's been walking along a stream and has come up against a beaver dam and has seen this explosion of life, there is something transformative in which to imagine recovering that on the large scale is really profound. It's a really exciting thing. And this is why I get back to, you know, people who hunt and fish and who value the species above and beyond their recreational opportunity, that ability to transform landscapes and to give back to those species that in turn bring them so much joy is really an incredible opportunity for me. And I guess that's something that's above and beyond just the practical expansion of water and expansion of habitat, is what does it mean to enter into this real community of life out there in which we benefit and in which we also give back.
Mind if I add a comment about the additional benefit related to water quality? Is this a good time?
Of course.
I was thinking about the interstitial space in the gravels and the sediments, and that compared to a stream system that has been splash dammed for over 70 years and scoured down to bedrock where there is no, you know, interstitial space. It's basically a bedrock flume or chute of water without that interconnected opportunity for that water to cool and be filtered. And with what comes off of our landscapes, with the additional chemicals and talk of forever chemicals and everything else that's just out in these systems interacting with the natural world in ways we're not even fully aware of, some of the data coming off of an introduced beaver colony site in North Devon, England. University of Exeter did some research both as the beavers were being released and the subsequent dams and the development of that really cool connected. I think in 7 years, this one beaver family of a pair, a mated pair, built 7 dams, and the equivalent of surface area, volumes of water, the documentation of the flood mitigation and the water quality and the amount of sediments that accumulate, you know, behind those beaver dams and those beaver complexes and the complexity of that habitat is just the perfect natural filter for the water quality downstream. And there's some really good data that's come out of places where, even in England, where all of the beavers were trapped out completely, as they start to have this controversial conversation around bringing beavers back, they're also studying, you know, the before and after.
So you're talking about the permeability of the substrate, basically for the water to move through and to filter. And when when those spaces are very small, it can't penetrate. But when it does, it can reconnect with the water table, and then it'll flow out further downstream after it cools off.
Exactly.
Yeah, I've experienced that because I like to wear sandals in the water because I love feeling the water on my toes. And, you know, I can tell, like, when I'm near a beaver dam complex or at the or kind of at the end, like, it'll really cool off and it's noticeable. So I can picture that 5 or 6 degrees difference, Suzanne, you're observing, you know, my toes kind of act as thermometers, not as scientific as your work. But.
Could I add just something to something that Tammy said, and it also sparked something that I missed, which was when you were talking about benefits, is the volume of dollars that we are spending on restoration. And Tammy's got some great examples. You know, we've got some here in my district, you know, building fence to protect aspen. So we've got food for beavers, but there's a lot of, you know, restoration going in. You know, there's real focus in putting in beaver dam analogs, sadly, in areas that are still being trapped. So there's kind of still this mismatch between the dollars we're spending on restoration while we're killing the, we're allowing as a recreational activity, you know, trapping and hunting of this keystone species. So the thing too is that dollars are becoming increasingly limited, and not only in Oregon, but everywhere, because the crises that deal with flooding and drought and wildfire, the demands on the financial resources, both at the state and federal level, are going way up. So if you're going to do restoration dollars, what you want to do is put your restoration dollars where beaver can't help or where beaver need an assist. So like they're building dams, but the channel's really incised. And so they keep getting their dams blown out. Then you go in and say, okay, beavers are there. We're going to do this. So it becomes a fiscally smart thing to do. And when all of us are taxpayers, all of us feel the pinch of being asked, you know, where are our taxpayers' dollars going? How are we seeing the benefits of them? Well, an amazing benefit can be restoration of our water systems. But let's make sure those dollars are really being spent in a way that makes sense. So why are we building beaver dam analogs in places that are perfect habitat for beaver? Why don't we have beavers there instead? And then we can take those dollars and put them in other places that require restoration. So I think that would be the ability to build and restore essentially for free in a lot of areas. And the other thing about beavers is that they're on the job 24/7. I walk and I see beaver dam analogs and they're starting to fall apart. And so there's money to put them in, but there's not always money for maintenance. It's okay, the project's done. Now we move on to the next project. But beavers, they're out there all the time. And so that ability to really partner in the restoration and being strategic in our limited tax dollars so that we actually see those benefits on the ground and that they can be amplified. And then I just have to laugh when you're talking about walking in the water and using your bare feet, your sandaled feet to tell you when the temperatures are changing. Way back in the 90s, and I was in the Gila National Forest. And this is early. So this is before I get just how bad systems are. And it's one of those perfect fall days. The big solo cottonwood, because all the cottonwoods are gone, except for the big one. And it's a, you know, blue sky, red rock. We're wandering the stream. We're going to be putting in some cross sections and measuring change. And I'm remarking about how just magical it is. And a woman by the name of Susan Schock, who was with Gila Watch, absolutely rips into me. And she goes, this is not beautiful. This is a really damaged system. Your mind has been trained to see this, to expect this, but this is not natural. And that may be one of the challenges that often folks who are using public lands, whether it's hunters and anglers or those of us who are out there hiking, is that it's all we've ever seen.
Historical amnesia.
Historical amnesia.
Cammie, your experiences on the coast, your restoration work, working for the Forest Service, I don't know who else you might have worked for or with out there, but can you talk about your restoration work and, you know, if beavers were around to assist you in that those efforts long term?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I was raising my hand a little when Suzanne was speaking because the other kind of continuation of that story related, not related to the beaver dam analogs, but related to resetting a system and wanting the beavers there. Just like when people put the beaver dam analogs in, you really need the beavers to come back and help continue that story. And so what we were doing on the Saisla to restore the natural processes, it was so flattering when the beavers would come back. We consider that the highest compliment. You know, they would come in within the first year after the restoration would take place, and we would use OWEB money and retained receipts from lottery sales and, you know, grant funds and restore the hydrology of these systems, and the beavers would come in. But sadly, when beavers do move into places like that, that are very public, they're often a target as well. And so in several of those places, it seemed that those beaver populations were targeted and removed, and those protections. So we had invested millions of dollars to reset the hydrology. A whole team, an interdisciplinary team of people, were designing and creating the plan for that landscape. And they were diverse and varied to some extent, but most of them low gradient stream valley bottoms or estuaries. And we were so excited to see beavers move in and pick up where we left off. And I guess I would like them to be able to pick up where we leave off, you know, especially if we're spending the kind of money and selecting an area specifically to restore the natural processes. Yeah, it's the highest compliment if the beavers return. I just want them to be able to stay.
Cami, do you see what you're talking about as being part of coexistence? Maybe you could just define coexistence and what coexistence with beavers might look like.
Sure. So I've been to a lot of sites in Washington where coexistence is the emphasis. In Oregon, I think there's a misunderstanding about beavers in Oregon. I'm seeing a lot of movement in Washington and in California toward valuing beavers across the landscape and increasing work to conserve and increase the populations of beavers across entire watersheds, if not the state, at the state level. Coexistence would be allowing beavers to be where they are and modifying our behaviors to allow them to be there. Doesn't mean that we have to move away completely from what we're doing on that landscape. It just means we have to adjust. Maybe it's the pond level and we can regulate that. Maybe it's trees that are being removed by beavers because they're silviculturists as well as hydrologists and engineers. Maybe it's certain ones are fenced. Maybe there's protections around culverts that beavers really like to plug. But if you remove that beaver colony, because they came in the first place, they're likely going to come again. So you might just be dealing with the next family that moves in and picks up where they left off if you've trapped out the previous colony. So it's likely better, more cost effective in the long run, and just better for the system overall if you can find coexistence strategies.
Suzanne, I hear a lot about beaver dam analogs, and both of you had mentioned beaver dam analogs. What are they, and why does the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management and other and nonprofit organizations who are involved with restoration work, why are beaver dam analogs all the rage right now, and what are some of their limitations?
Sure. I guess the first thing I want to say is that I think a lot of folks who are building beaver dam analogs are doing it with the best of intentions. They're looking at systems that are incised. This is the possibility of maybe raising the water table and things like that. But I think it's really important to make a distinction between what beaver dam analogs are and what beavers do, because there's some real differences. So beaver dam analogs are, it's kind of like they sound. They're going to try to mimic a beaver dam. So they put in a bunch of posts, vertical posts, and then they weave between the posts vegetation. It could be willows, it could be conifers, it could be whatever. And the idea is that as the water comes up against those beaver dam analogs, which now are, you know, posts and woven material, that the water will pond and back up and slow down and begin to ideally spill out onto the valley floor. The challenge that I see with them is that oftentimes, one, dollars are available to build them, but not to maintain them. And I'm not sure how much data is actually out there being collected on how frequently they need to be maintained. One professor I know, Dr. Matt Orr out of Central Oregon, has been looking at them and is finding that, in fact, maintenance is pretty required. I've heard sort of that the Bridge Creek Beaver Dam analogs also required maintenance. I talked to some folks in Idaho Department of Fish and Game, and they had hired for the first time a crew to go out and manage their beaver dam analogs because they get washed, you know, they break down, they get the river wraps around them, and suddenly they're no longer effective. So one of the challenges is that as human beings, we tend to move on to the next project, or we would love to be able to go back, but there's just no time. If beavers move into that system, sometimes what they'll do is they'll take advantage of those beaver dam analogs. They will build on them. They can expand on them. Those beaver dam analogs can be incredibly effective if you're in a situation like in Bridge Creek in Central Oregon, where there was a closure. The beavers were expanding. They were building dams. You'd have high flows because it was a very incised channel. The dams were getting knocked out. So they put in some beaver dam analogs, and that was just enough of a speed bumps to really slow down the power of the stream. And what that did is beavers now were building on some of the beaver dam analogs, and then they were expanding beyond it, and the dams were holding. To answer your question about why is it all the rage, and that's sort of how it feels, because there's been several cases where beaver dam analogs are being built, but beaver trapping is still being permitted. Or beaver dam analogs are being built, and people are saying, look at the amazing changes that are happening in terms of all these increase in beaver dams. And they're neglecting to mention that the area has actually been closed to beaver trapping as well. I think part of it gets into this thing is that we as human beings, especially those of us who are hydrologists or restoration folks, and we see how much damage there is out there. And there is a longing to get out there and do something to see if we can transform. I think the other thing, too, is that putting in beaver dam analogs is not politically challenging. It might be technically challenging in the sense of getting your permits and things like that, but it is not socially or politically challenging. Whereas, say, closing areas, say, like if we were to close federally managed public lands to beaver trapping and hunting, and say, you know, they've got a value to restore these systems like Cammie's talked about, to restore things for people who hunt and fish, that they've got other value than just a recreational opportunity for a small number of people. That is a technically easy thing to do. It is a politically and socially complicated thing to do. And so we tend to drift to that which is least socially and politically complicated. But the difficulty is, and this is where I oftentimes struggle, is you take a tool that has value when done in places where you've really kind of thought it through. We've got beavers, or we're about to reintroduce beavers, and so we need some good holding ponds. Or we are prepping a site for beavers. And you make it be the solution because you don't want to deal with the politically challenging thing. And so a lot of those folks tend to be quiet. You might not even know that the area is being trapped. And it worries me because as drought expands and its severity and frequency expands, as flooding becomes more of a problem in other areas and as wildfire, we're kind of running out of time. And so what we need to be doing is if we're going to build beaver dam analogs, let's make sure we've got the beaver there to move in. Kind of like Cammie's story. If we're going to invest those dollars, we've got to have the beavers there. And so that's where my frustration is, that we're taking a tool and we're using it in some respects. This is my perception anyway. We're using it as a substitute for what we really need, which is beavers. And places like OWED and other granting agencies, I'm not sure how many of them ask the basic question, are there beaver in your area and are beavers being trapped? And using that as a criteria for whether or not this makes a good investment of public dollars. Cammie, do you have something else you might want to add?
Yeah, I don't think that beaver dam analogs can or are intended to replace beavers. And I think even the people that you would ask that are doing it would agree, I think. I mean, maybe not everyone, but I think that there are missing pieces to the beaver dam analog, which makes me think of it more as a Band-Aid And sometimes that Band-Aid is just enough, like Suzanne said, you know, at Bridge Creek, maybe it was just enough to, you know, to get beavers to work with the, it slowed the velocities. It allowed them to really move in and build structures that could sustain beaver dams that could sustain on that landscape on their own once the beaver dam analogs had done what they were intended. But if we're just putting beaver dam analogs in and walking away without really thinking about that bigger context, they are just going to fail. You know, beaver dams, when beavers construct them, they are working on them, you know, 365 days of the year, and they don't stop unless that beaver pond fills in completely and they don't have the depth of water that they need, and then they move somewhere else, maybe up a tributary or downstream or somewhere else, but they then expand their work and they keep at it. So it isn't, I would just add that yeah, I don't think they can stand alone.
Cammie, how should we be thinking about beavers on public lands specifically as opposed to private lands?
Well, it's interesting. When I was with the Sayula National Forest, people think about beavers differently depending on what department they're in, even within public land management, because everybody has a different task and a different role that they fill. And so, you know, an engineer would look at a beaver dam that's on a culvert very differently than me. A camp host at a site where beavers have been causing problems with a particular road access would look at them very differently too than I would. Wildlife biologists, fisheries biologists, and hydrologists see them as, you know, encompassing all these benefits that we've talked about. Most of the hydrologists, fisheries biologists, and wildlife folks that I've worked with. And on public lands, I think it's really important that we be thinking about it just like that, holistically. And on every national forest that I'm familiar with, I think the approach to beavers is different depending on where you are and who the manager is. So it does concern me. I wish there was a more unified strategy when a beaver's doing something on the landscape. I wish that everybody could and did chime in about the benefits that are happening at that site and not just be addressing it from a concern or an issue or a crisis standpoint. I think public lands should be managed really differently. And I think that all of those interconnected benefits should be considered before any actions taken on, you know, beavers that are on that public landscape.
Suzanne, have there been efforts to protect beavers on public lands? You can use Oregon as an example, or you could use other states. But so if we're all in agreement that beavers are really important, and I know the three of us are, and I have to assume that, you know, greater society would agree with us, there must have been efforts to protect these critters. And what, if any, you know, are some of those efforts that you could talk about?
Yeah. I would say the desire to actually make a change in Oregon, which of course is the state I'm most familiar with, you know, it's been going on for a long time. I mean, in 1994, the Willow Whitman asked for a closure. And I know the Sayula, the Ochoco, there have been a number of national forests in the 90s that were asking for closures, a couple of them. I think that, you know, and then you start getting beaver management work groups, you know, in 2008, 2013, and nothing's really changing, even as the literature is expanding and the understanding of the value of beavers and what they bring in terms of water and habitat bring to the larger community is expanding. So, you know, there's efforts to go to the state and say, you know, hey, can we protect this species on public lands? Because public lands bring these wide array of benefits to all of these communities. And in 2020 was the first real effort on the part of scientists, economists, citizens, and conservation groups to go to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission and say, look, we're asking formally, can you do this during the trapping closure when the rules are open for modification? And there was an attempt to say, look, these are all the benefits. We all agree on the benefits. And that really didn't go anywhere, for a number of reasons that I won't get into, largely just because I don't want to go on too long. Then again, there was a second effort that was done in November of 2020, in which it was a petition. And that petition was much more formalized under the Oregon Administrative Act. And it said, we're asking for, you know, a rulemaking. And that begins a large conversation among all Oregonians. Do we want beavers protected? And that was denied by the commission on a 3-3 vote. And, you know, it's like, well, we'll have another beaver management work group. That was it. And, you know, there was a lot of concern about that because the prior two beaver management work groups had really produced nothing. There was also an attempt in 2021 legislative session that brought forward and said, look, given the crisis in Oregon, the drought, the wildfire, the flooding, the declining salmon, all of these issues, the water quality issues, the need to provide for our communities drinking water as well as water to grow crops and for our fish, we're asking now the state to do it. And why ask the state? Well, in fact, Oregon has been closed twice before, fully closed to beaver trapping and hunting. The first closure and what I'm really tickled, you know, living here in Eastern Oregon, is that the very first two counties that asked for a closure are in 18-3, Baker and Malheur County. And the folks who bring that request forward are ranchers. And they bring it forward because they're seeing that they're having real water problems. And then by 1899, the entire state is closed for water resource issues. It's closed until about 1917, where a couple counties start to get open. And then by 1923, most of Oregon is reopened because, of course, what we start to have happen is beaver populations are expanding. They're starting to get into ditches and things like that. And so that there is a decision by the state legislature to open large parts of the state. But what's really interesting is national forests stay closed. There's a recognition even back then that national forests provided a unique contribution to Oregonians. And then there's some southwestern states that are counties that stay closed. 8 years later, the state is closed again. The numbers have crashed again because the trapping pressure was so high. And probably the numbers had really not gotten to be really robust. So they're closed for another 20 years. Now, that second closure is kind of interesting because then you have a game department and you have state trappers that are relocating beavers onto national forests. You have landowners who are requesting beavers. And then beaver numbers begin to expand again. And the state trappers are moving from live trapping to dead trapping. And then in 1951, the state legislature opens up again. But the national forest stays closed. Now, at some point that changes after 1959, which is the end of this publication, that changes. And the national forests are opened up. And what's interesting, so BLM land, of which there is a lot, particularly over here in Eastern Oregon, you know, that kind of comes onto the scene much later than national forests. So in these early publications, Bureau of Land Management land is not talked about. And yet beaver are really critical. And, you know, you talked about your time in Nevada, Adam. And just seeing what beavers can do, even in this very dry landscape, which is, you know, BLM landscape. And so now what we have in the modern day is we have a number of closures. And some of them, like the Ochoco National Forest, is fully closed. And the value is seen by the forest such that in 2020, when the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife wanted to open it, the forest supervisor said, thank you very much, but no. We're seeing the benefits. We want to continue to protect beavers. You've got the Bridge Creek, which has seen, you know, tremendous improvement as a result of the closure. But a lot of the closures are really small and they're kind of inappropriate. You know, we talk about beavers moving and dispersing. And so you've got places like Murderers Creek and Deer Creek in Graham County, and just the main stems are closed. The forage base is wide open. So when beavers leave to go forage, it's open and all the tributaries are open. In southwestern Oregon, the Rogue River, the main stem, is closed, but all the tributaries are open and all the land base is open. You've got some of the sites up in the Wallowas in northeast Oregon. They're closed, but these are steep systems. So again, what, you know, you oftentimes hear, well, the closures don't work. Well, the closures do work. But they've got to be at the right scale. They've got to allow beavers to disperse. beavers have to be protected not only in terms of water, land-based. And what you really need is that you need beavers to be able to go out into the landscape and select their spots. And we might not think it's ideal, but they may find it totally acceptable. And then they can begin this process of expanding, rising the water table, expanding riparian vegetation. So there have been a lot of attempts to close public lands in Oregon that we've gone before the commission. And I know, Adam, you've been part of it. Cami, I know the Cayuse Law made a big push for it in 2020, and we just haven't been able to get any. And it's really particularly disappointing because you'll hear the fish, you know, the wildlife staff saying, yeah, beaver are really important. You'll hear the commissioner say, yes, beaver are really important. We'll talk about all these benefits. And yet what they'll then say is that, well, we don't think it's trap. We think it's habitat. And I think all of us who spend any time on public lands would be in agreement that there are places where habitat is definitely severely compromised. But there are plenty of places on public lands in which the habitat is there. And so I just want to make one final point, because this came up in the most recent effort in 2024, of which you, Adam, were part of that, where we went before the commission and we asked again. And now we're 4 years later, major droughts for the last 4 years, big wildfires, salmon numbers are continuing to not do well. And we get again, status quo. And one of the things that the Oregon Fish and Wildlife staff said is, hey, not very many beavers are coming off public lands. And the number was like 45. All of them, most of them are coming off private lands. And it's kind of interesting because there's some confusion about how they were dividing up some of the areas. But let's just assume 45. We have 32 million acres of public land and only 45 beavers came off. Let's assume that's true. Obviously, the trapping and the hunters associations are insisting that they keep it open. So there's interest. So why are there only a few beavers coming off? And the answer is because there aren't very many on public lands. And that means when there aren't very many on public lands, if you take out two beavers out of a watershed, and that is the only two beavers in that watershed, they just arrived, that is 100%. And all those benefits that we've talked about are absolutely not going to happen. So a lot of effort's gone in. It hasn't gone anywhere. The state, that Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has been resistant. And, you know, there's always arguments. It's habitat. We're not taking very many. The fact is that when a trapping closure takes place, at the appropriate scales, the literature is very clear, numbers go up, and so do distribution, and so do the benefits.
Cami, how important is every single beaver out there? And I think the stats show about, what, less than 150 trappers in Oregon. Just how important is each beaver, and how should we be thinking about those small numbers in addition to what Suzanne just said?
Yeah, thank you for asking that, Adam. The reason that the Cayuse Law at the time that I was there as the watershed program manager pursued the trapping closure was in part because, well, it was because of what we were seeing on the landscape where we had completed investments to restore the hydrology and where beavers were moving back but then disappearing. And we didn't have, you know, on Karnowski Creek, which was a restoration that took place in 2005, a valley bottom stream tributary to the Cayuse River, there were 27 beaver dams by year three upon the completion of that restoration project. You know, I don't have acre feet of water volume estimates for you, but I can tell you that dramatically changed that valley bottom. And holding water year-round, backwatering tributaries, sub-irrigating native vegetation across that entire, you know, valley bottom. To have all 27 beaver dams essentially start to fail at about the same time, about the same rate, you know, that's not cougar predation, that's trapping of a colony. And that at that point, there were probably, you know, it started as a pair, mated pair, they have about two kits per year. There was probably subadults from a, you know, from a previous year or two and new kits. I would bet there were likely only 4 to 6 beavers there at that time that built 27 beaver dams. So when I would push back with ODF&W folks and say, well, what's the beaver population across the state? If you're telling me there's not a problem with trapping, then tell me what the numbers are, because we're not seeing them persist in these places where they used to be, nor are we seeing them persist where we expect them to come back or where they have come back, but then they're gone within a year or two. And the population estimates are based on the harvest numbers. And the harvest numbers that have been shared with me are only shared by county. So you can't tell really where or what ownership, you know, those beavers are coming off of. What you do know, though, is when they aren't there. And I would argue that one family, one colony of beavers is making a huge difference in terms of flood attenuation, water table regulation, water quality downstream, water temperature downstream, winter rearing habitat, biodiversity of so many different species. So does that answer your question?
That's great. So just having a couple beaver present, even those that pair or four beavers can be so influential in modifying the habitat and providing the services. But it's also the seeds for the next generation, right?
Exactly. They disperse from there and they move, you know, up and downstream, and if they're allowed.
And so you could have two, and then the next year you could have however many, and then it could keep growing and growing as long as that habitat's suitable. And then those beavers are going to move and stray and then reseed other valleys and then continue on. But when you kill the goose that lays the golden egg in each one of these watersheds, then you set the system back, you know, recovery indefinitely. And as we know from the science, and Suzanne, you've pointed this out, that sometimes it can take decades for a pair of beavers to find themselves back in an isolated system. So every single one of those beavers is critical. And if we're taking even 40 or 50 out every year, that is very substantial from a biological and an ecological standpoint.
Can I just give a great case example using the Devon, England site that Cammie mentioned, when you just talk about what a pair can do? So, you know, when they moved in, just to get a sense, this was a first order stream. This is like high. This was a stream that is less than 700 feet long. And when they built, they got to the seven, and then they built as many as 13 dams. Okay, so this starts with two. And that is, they start building in 2011. And by 2014, there are 13 dams. So here's the amount of water in 2014 that they were now holding in reserve and allowing to slowly move through was over 300,000 gallons. I mean, we're talking about a tiny stream. So you take those beavers out, I mean, there's no more water storage. Those dams will fail, the channel will incise. And so, you know, you think about, you know, Cammie's example, which is a much larger example. But again, how important are two? Well, wow, if two can give you over 300,000 gallons of water in 4 years, stored and contributing to the system and expanding in those wetlands and all that kind of stuff, that's pretty important.
Indeed. And I have a story. I was down in the Trout Creek Mountains about a month ago or so, and I was up in the headwaters. This is down in Southeast Oregon. I want to say it was about 6,000 feet, maybe. Yeah, it was about there. So I'm way high up, and I'm in this drainage, and I find some springs and they're flowing, and only like, I want to say 500 feet below these springs, there was a little beaver dam, and it was like 4 feet long or something like that. And there were little cutthroat trout holding behind it. This was like way up on the mountainside, this little tiny beaver dam. And there were all these little beaver dams, and they were getting bigger as I'm going down. So I could just imagine, you know, a beaver or two maybe just kind of working up in these headwaters. And it was just amazing to see beavers damming up this little tiny creek at such high elevation. It was just incredible to see that. So, you know, just a few beavers can really do a lot.
I'm smiling because I've seen it over and over again in the Coast Range. And some sites, you know, I've seen recent work come from some biologists at OSU calling the Coast Range kind of a lost cause, because the beaver dams in the Coast Range are ephemeral. They only last a couple of years and then they just get blown out. But I can tell you that I've got longstanding data on beaver dams high up in coastal systems on these tributaries, these slump bench terrain, you know, past kind of rotational landslides where these beavers just take this opportunity and create this, beautiful wetland that has sustained, you know, I have a track record on it for over 27 years. So there are many of these, not as long as, you know, that's my longest standing one that I have record of, but it's so wonderful to come across these when you're, you know, you're looking at a trickle in a 1 foot to a 3 foot wide stream channel, might go subsurface for part of the year, but you come across these beaver wetlands that have persisted and are holding so much water and feeding that system downstream for, you know, all year, every year for 27 years, you know, so. But when we splash dammed, we removed a lot of the large wood, and large wood would have been key to ability of these beaver dams to be keyed in and stay, you know, through big flashy floods. So,
yeah, it's just still hard to imagine the scale and scope at which beavers impacted the biodiversity and species richness of this continent and all of these ecosystems that they created as ecosystem engineers and as the keystone species. It really is just hard to kind of wrap your head around. But with these little examples out there in the landscape, we get to go visit on public lands and see and monitor. And hopefully as we start to progress here a bit on the management policy side, we'll actually see those big changes that we want to see. And I hope we're on the cusp of a watershed moment here, no pun intended. And, you know, we'll start to see some big moves on the policy side and something to celebrate. And let's hope that we can get there. Suzanne, I want to ask you, we're getting up here on an hour and a half. I think that'd be a good place to close. So maybe another 10 minutes. But if you could talk about the importance of beavers offsetting this loss of snowpack that we're seeing every year. I mean, they're talking now the Cascades may be snow-free now in the summer in the next 20 to 30 years. I mean, that's just really crazy to think about.
Sure, Adam. That's such a great question because those of us who are older, the snowpack has been something we've just always taken for granted. And frankly, it's something we've taken for granted. People have taken for granted when it comes to something as simple as skiing and finding that the ski season is changing very dramatically. The snowpack, you know, there used to be a deep snowpack and it would melt slowly. And so what you would have is water coming out of the mountains through the summer. And that would provide the water for ranching, for farming, for cities, for our wild neighbors. And it was this sort of gradual, relatively gradual melt. What we're seeing now is more rain as temperatures warm up, is that more of the precip in the winter is coming as rain, not as snow. And sometimes what we're seeing is the snow melt is coming off sooner, which means if you're wanting your snow melt to be coming off in May, June, July, and August, it's now coming off, it's starting to come off earlier. So the tendency has been in the past is, well, we'll just build large dams. And those dams will hold water in reserve for irrigation, maybe for hydropower. But dams, human-constructed dams, are really this sort of, I think of it as the yearly paycheck. If you get a good flow, they fill up. If you get bad flows, especially consistently, what you see is those reservoirs just don't fill up. So what you need is something that is going to be storing water in abundance that can buffer the fact that the snowpack's not there anymore or it's melting sooner. And that's what the beaver ponds do, and that's what the wetlands do, is that those ponds store water and slowly release it. The wetlands store water both, you know, sort of spreading out on the surface and in the ground. And that water is just kind of held in reserve. And then as the beaver ponds drop, water begins to move into the ponds and continues down the stream. So, and the beauty of the beaver ponds, which make him so different than the sort of human constructed dams, is that it's kind of the savings account. It's the water savings account. So during years of abundance, you get flooding of those wetlands, you get recharge of the groundwater, you get those ponds filling up. And then during those periods when you have drought, the river is able to draw or receives that water that is held in reserve. And that's really different than our human constructed reservoirs. What it does also mean, though, is that if you've got all these beaver ponds and these wetlands up on public lands, is that during dry years, you will have more water coming into those reservoirs for downstream use too. So it can really help offset this sort of boom and bust that we sometimes are starting to see increasingly in our reservoir storage, in which even during drought, you're getting some water coming in. And then during those years of a lot of abundance, you're getting your reservoirs filled, but you're also getting a lot of additional storage. And so it really evens out the peaks and the valleys in terms of that water and will help compensate, kind of become the new storage system in part to offset the fact that storage system, which is the snowpack, is over. Now, historically, that's how it would have been anyway. Historically, we would have had snowpacks and we would have had wetlands and we would have had ponds. And so we really had a very robust water-rich and water-stable system. And so now what we're looking at is as we lose the snowpack, which I guess if you're thinking in financial terms, is one of your assets, you've got to get the other one back in place, which is the wetlands and the ponds. So at least you have some natural storage taking place on the land. And again, we've got a lot of public lands here in the West, a lot of potential for recovery.
So when I think about all these little dams, I think about spreading out your assets across the retirement portfolio, right? You don't want to just have one stock. You want to diversify. So when we have all these beaver dams, you could have a few fail and then the others can back up. And it's just really smart. It's sort of a decentralization and you're hedging your bets across the landscape. I also think about human man-made dams and their impediment to fish and salmon and trout. And then I think about beaver dams, which on the aggregate, you know, are very helpful for fish. So there's sort of that, just an interesting juxtaposition there to think about the different natural versus man-made infrastructure and how it's either harming or helping species. All right, so I want to wrap this up here, but I always ask all of my guests, what do public lands mean to you? And I want to start with you, Cammie.
It's interesting because the Northwest Forest Plan is up for revision and going through revision right now. And I've spent my career over 22 years implementing the Northwest Forest Plan. And I think for me, I have to talk about that in response to this question. So when I was leaving the CAISLA and making the decision to go somewhere else with my career, I struggled with the third generation removed, if you've ever heard of that. The first generation would have authored the Northwest Forest Plan. The second generation would have been implementing the Northwest Forest Plan. And the third generation is the third generation is removed from both of those things. So they didn't author it. So they don't fully, you know, like they're not taking ownership of it. They didn't implement it. And here they are showing up and saying, what is this Northwest Forest Plan? Why does it exist? How did it come about? Well, I grew up in Cottage Grove, Oregon during the timber wars and came from a family of loggers. Their business went under when the spotted owl stuff hit, but instead of shying away from that, I started calling spotted owls. And a lot of my family, I think, would have liked to have disowned me at that point, but I have so much value. Everything about the public lands to me in Western Oregon signify collaboration and finding a better road forward. The path that my uncles were on was not sustainable. The path that a lot of loggers and folks were on in the late 80s, all, you know, well before that, but it all came to a head in the late 80s. That path was not sustainable. But the people that were brought together to build the Northwest Forest Plan collaborated across the table and came up with a plan that everybody could get behind. Maybe they weren't happy with it, but everybody could see a way forward. And I think that's what public land is all about. It was hard for me to leave the CAISLA when I did to see the Northwest Forest Plan under revision. And I hope that there's a lot of other people paying attention. And that it isn't just falling victim to a, you know, third generation removed scenario. I would hate to see us go backward. And the Coast Range has so much mature forests. I just finished the book, Finding the Mother Tree, by Dr. Suzanne Simard. And I think for a lot of my life, I've been sold a kind of a bill of goods around private industrial forestry. And I know this isn't what you asked me necessarily, but I am very bothered by the fact that we've turned our forests into corn crops, monoculture and a 30-year rotation. I can't imagine what that's done to the mycorrhizae and the soils and the carbon sequestration potential of those forests. And I think about the fire intensities that burn through those places now that we've done that to those landscapes. And one of my very first experiences was I was doing a road survey for, I was looking at the Forest Practices Act on roads in Western Oregon. And I came across this hillside with my coworker, and we drove up into the Millicoma Tree Farm, which was a Weyerhaeuser landscape that looked like a bomb had gone off. It was as far as you could see. It was clear cuts, burns, spraying, so altered, it really shocked me. And I started diving into that more deeply and what's going on in Western Oregon and why is this how we're doing it? And, you know, I was told what everybody's told is, well, that's how you have to grow trees in Oregon. It's the only way you can outcompete the weeds and it's the only way. And having implemented the Northwest Forest Plan for most of my working time over the past 20 years, I just completely disagree. So to me, I see so much value in the fact that the Sayula National Forest has been able to harvest about 50 million board feet annually, just shy of that, between 40 and 50 million board feet annually since 1994 when the Northwest Forest Plan was put in place, and keep 80 plus year old trees, and then for late successional reserve type mature stand qualities, to me, that's what public lands are.
Suzanne?
Yeah, like Cami, I spent my 16 years at the Wallowa National Forest implementing the Northwest Forest Plan, pack fish in fish here on the dry east side. And, you know, it was interesting because now that it's up for revision, I spent some time sort of looking at it and putting in my comments. And I always find myself coming back to, why did the forest reserves come into place? Why did the national forests come? Which is a pretty remarkable thing. And a lot of it has to do with what's happening back east with overcutting, flooding, and a recognition as that they needed to take a slightly different approach here. And out of the 1897 Organic Act, there were two components about why the forest reserves go into play. One is water. One is to make sure that forest reserves are to ensure continuous flow of water. They recognize its importance. And the second one was timber supply. Well, the Forest Service has been great with timber supply. They have been very weak on their water. And so when I was writing in my comments, I said, you know, the aquatic conservation strategy is not sufficient. It doesn't talk about beavers. It doesn't talk about the role that the national forests play in fact, providing water to communities locally and downstream. And this is a weakness of the revision. And so when Cami, I had not heard of the third generation approach, the three debt. But yeah, I found myself really anxious about the fact that we are revising something and we are really sort of saying, oh, well, the aquatic restoration strategy, the aquatic conservation strategy, that sort of takes care of it. And it's like, no, it doesn't at all. And so here we are moving into a time in which water is going to become increasingly important and scarcity is going to be a cause of a tremendous conflict. And the agency's not even really talking about it and has really decided not to talk about it. So when to your question, you know, what does public lands mean to me? There is that, I mean, I find myself deeply invested still as somebody who's retired. I spent the last week picking up temperature loggers, being out there, looking at what's going on in the landscape, in some cases feeling captivated by just the beauty of it, and in some cases really grieving about what I'm seeing and about the fact that the agencies are not actively restoring the landscape, particularly when it comes to stream riparian wetland areas. And they're so important because think about the fact that in the United States, particularly in the West, but smaller portions in the East, access. I can go onto those public lands and I do not have to ask permission. I'm going to guess, Adam, when we get to what do they mean to you, as a hunter and an angler, you know, you've got to get a permit and you have areas that you can go into, but you're not asking for permission. And so that sense of that collective ownership and that ability, when I think back onto my history of being out with, you know, my folks taking us out camping on public lands, you know, there's pictures when I go through of, you know, me and my brother holding a fish, you know, being really excited and all that time. So that opportunity of public lands to be in a place that allows us to reconnect with ourselves, to have quiet time, to get to know our wild neighbors, it's an incredible gift. And it creates lifetime experiences. And I have to say this. Okay, so again, I'm not a hunter and I really don't fish. But when I read the articles in my local paper, and I especially hear older hunters talking about taking young folks out, they talk about creating that whole experience about what it means to be out in the woods and getting to know the species. And that there is this lifetime creation of experiences. And that is something that can only happen on public lands. And that's on top of every all the other benefits they give us. Water, carbon sequestration, migratory birds. So to me, it is an incredible gift that we in the United States have, that we in Oregon have, that we in the West have. And it is upon us to do everything in our power to make them as healthy and diverse and able to weather climate change so that all those species, all those wild, all of our wild neighbors and all of our human communities can thrive. And so I just look at that and I think it's an amazing gift and we need to do a better job taking care of it. And I'm very grateful that I got to work for the Forest Service and really connect. And I'm really grateful as a private citizen to be able to experience those lands still.
Great. Well, thanks for both of your answers. I really appreciate it. And, you know, when we're thinking about beavers and the sort of leadership that we're going to need in whether it's state government or the Fish and Game Commission or the state agents or the federal agencies like the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management, it's really time for leadership to emerge across the board and to start protecting beavers on behalf of all of us. It's really time. So here's to a bright future with lots of beavers in it. I want to thank both of you for your time and for your dedication to public lands and beavers. So I really appreciate both of you and what you do. And it's always a pleasure speaking with you. So Suzanne, I'll just hand it to you for real brief closing comments and then over to Cammie and we'll wrap it up.
Adam, thanks so much for this opportunity. And Cammie, as always, it is delightful to share time with you and compare our stories and our similarities. So thanks, Adam, for the podcast and to all your listeners.
Thank you both. Thank you, Suzanne. And it's always a pleasure. Our paths have crossed many times. I'm always glad when that happens. And Adam, I've enjoyed this time. It went by fast. Yeah. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, me too. Thank you. There's a lot more to talk about beavers. Maybe we could do another episode about their biology and their habitat needs and that sort of stuff. We haven't even really touched on that. So
that's true.
All right. Well, thank you both so much. Have a nice rest of your day. Thanks for listening to this episode of Our Public Lands. This program is produced and hosted by me, Adam Bronstein. If you'd like to reach out, please email me at contact@ourpubliclandspodcast.com. Original music by Karen Daniel. You can find Karen's music online at karendaniel.com. Thanks for listening.